It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss, certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Today on Money Matters, is the bear market over? Is the bear out of the woods? History as our guide today here on this Sunday morning. Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. Wes Moss here along with Ryan Ely. And you're probably saying, Wes, aren't we in a bear market, or is the bear market over? There's confusion around where we really stand in this current market cycle. We had just an enormous pullback in the fall that really was climactic almost going into Christmas, really nightmare before Christmas. Christmas Eve was really, at least for now, was the lowest point that we hit and marked a 20% down a period of time. So that's a bear market. So once you hit a bear market, you're still in a bear market for a relatively long period of time, or at least until you technically get back to where you were, or you look back and you say, well, that spot right there marked a bottom. So just because we've rallied 10.5% from that period of time, it doesn't mean that we're necessarily out of the woods just yet. So today, where do we stand in this current really bear market cycle? What does history tell us about the next year or two once a bear market is triggered? And of course, this has enormous implications for every investor that is chosen to join us this morning. And thank you for being with us, because it directly impacts all of our 401ks, all of our investment accounts, anyone that has any exposure to equities, even dividend or high quality dividend companies. They get caught up in the storm, at least to some extent. And so it impacts us all. Unless we're just stashing money away in CDs or government treasuries or stable value, we are part of this, what has been the most volatile market that we've seen arguably since the great financial crisis. Now, so today I want to go through the history of bear markets, very much identifying the kind that we just entered into, which we believe is a relatively short-term bear market, or considered a bear market within a secular or long-term, pretty good overall trend. Obviously, we have had a wonderful market trend since March of 2009. We believe we're still in that longer-term trend that is over time positive, but during those long periods of time, you're going to have big, big pullbacks, and pullbacks that are big enough for you to question, is the long-term ride, are the good days for stocks, are they over? So let's get through the history today of how long these things take before they stop going down. This week, we pulled research and looked at markets all the way back to 1903. So we captured every single bear market and correction really for over a century. We did the research on how long it takes for them to trough. So really think of it as peak down to bottom. And then how long does it take to go from bottom back to where we were, or bottom back to peak? What does that cycle look like? Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. Of course, the phone lines here are open, 404-872-0750. 1-800-WSB-TALK. I know last week we didn't get to all the questions we wanted to get to. If you're facing some sort of financial question mark, maybe you were being offered some sort of package. And again, I've already started to hear the layoff stories. They're not layoff stories, really. These are downsize stories. These are early exit package stories. So if you're a big company in the Southeast and you've got 20,000 employees, it's uncommon if they don't offer something up to 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 people that says, hey, you were expecting to work another 2 or 3 years or even 5 years, but if we give you 6 months salary or a year salary and give you the option to take your pension as a lump sum and roll it in an IRA or take it as an annuity for the rest of your life, hey, would you be willing to exit early? Those are huge financial implications. There's a lot to think about there. So if you're faced with some sort of decision that involves a lump sum or a pension, maybe you're just thinking about, what am I investing in today? Should it be mutual funds? Should I look at ETFs? Maybe individual companies? all those questions answered here, whether it's that or a tax question here that relates back to your investments. We are here to be on the phones with you, answer your specific question, which we believe we're still the most objective financial radio show, really by far, left in the nation. So we are always so excited to be here with you on a Sunday morning. So today we're talking bear market history. Then I want to look at something that we believe the market almost has backwards. The market right now is discounting companies that are really the highest quality of company. Companies that really have solid balance sheets. So their foundation is strong. They may not be growing quite as fast as Netflix, but their foundation is so strong that you know they can weather the next storm whenever we go through it. Yet the market isn't giving them credit for that, meaning that they're trading at lower prices or lower valuations. And in many cases, those are the companies that pay really significant payouts or dividends. I want to go through that. So the underappreciated high-quality companies that are in the market, so the market's kind of getting that backwards. It's rewarding, or you're having to pay up for crappy companies, and you're looking at companies that you should have to pay up for, and you don't have to. And I want to go through some of those examples here today on the show. So plenty to cover here today on Money Matters. Of course, the number in the studio, 404-872-0750. Again, we talk about the history now. Let's talk about the history of these bear markets. What happens a year or two later when a bear market gets triggered? Remember, it's not uncommon. The market was up again this week, up 2.4% for the Dow, up 2.5% for the S&P 500. We're only in the going into the third week of January. And you're saying, well, things seem pretty good. Doesn't this mean we're in the clear? It's not uncommon, even in these bear markets. So still before we get officially kind of climb out of the cellar, it's not uncommon to get 10, 12, 15% rallies during bear markets. As a reminder, despite the rally we've had since Christmas of 2018, only time will really tell when we're really out of the market. You've got to be out of it and look back and say, okay, that was that day, that week, that was the bottom. Historically, here's though what happens in bear markets. And again, as a reminder, there are two types of bears. We've got the one with recession, which means those are the really bad ones because it's a bad market inside of a terrible economy. Those are the 40, 50%ers. The ones without recession, so bear markets within a good economy, like the one we are in today, those are the two kinds. So we're talking about the latter, the bears, you could even think of it as these mini or mild bears in an economy without a recession. We don't think we're going into a recession still anytime soon, and we certainly were not in a recession over the course of last fall when the bear market occurred. We look at these in these larger we also look at bear markets in terms of larger cycles. Again, is the longer-term trend up or down? Well, we believe we're still in one of those secular long-term bull markets that started back in 2009. In a long-term or secular bear market, pullbacks of any kind, corrections, bear markets like the one we're in, they're just more mild than when we're in the middle of a long-term downtrend or secular bear markets, which we just don't think we're in. A secular bear market was, if you think about the long period of time, the decade or so that or almost full decade that stocks went nowhere. That really started in 2000, 2001 with a big correction. We rallied back, another huge correction. It really took about a decade just to get back to even. That was a secular bear. We're not in that anymore. So we believe we're in this long-term bull. So the overall 10, 20-year trend in these long-term bulls is up. But of course, you have corrections and these mild bears along the way. So where are we in this current bear cycle? So we're in one of those bear markets right now. Yeah, yes, we rallied 10.5% since the lows of Christmas Eve. But once you hit the down 20% mark, that's correction territory. That correction that hit really all fall, and we hit down 20% on Christmas Eve day, that put us in the bear market category historically. That's where we are today. not just correction, different, not just correction territory, but bear market territory. September 20th really was the high for the S&P 500, all the way down to December 24th of last year. The S&P dropped 20%, a full 20%. Now, we closed, that was an intraday basis. We closed down 19.8%, but to be exact, but 20% at one point. You can actually identify bear markets or bears with less downside than we actually had. One of our research partners actually has a more complicated definition for these bear markets. But from our perspective, from my perspective, there is no question here. We are in bear territory. So here's how markets have played out historically when that happens. A bad market in an otherwise solid, long-term, multi-year good market like we think we are in, and we looked at all bear cycles that are in all bear markets and cyclical bear markets. These are the more mild ones since 1903. So a lot of research years. We're going to go through peak to trough. How long did it take? Then trough back to peak. How long did that take? On average, from peak to trough, to really put in a bottom, it takes on average 9 months. 9 months to bottom out. On average, it's not uncommon to rally 10, 12% or even more, like we just have done, by the way, and then retest those lows or put in a new low even before really putting in a bottom. On average, that process takes 9 months. Right now, we're in about month four, about 4 months in. So yes, we could have seen the bottom Christmas week, or we could see markets retest those lows, flounder around over the next several months before really putting in a bottom. By the way, the average decline in these bear markets or cyclical bears is 21.8%. We almost got to that exact level, interestingly. When Money Matters returns, we're talking trough back to peak, and then what history tells us how long the whole cycle is when Money Matters returns. Right here, News 95.5 AM 750 WSB. Well, good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here, WSB Radio. Good morning, your host, Wes Moss. On a Sunday morning here with Ryan Ealy. We're going to go to the phones here. Rick joins us from North Atlanta. Rick, what's going on, man? How can I help?
Hi, Wes. Great show.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted to ask you, last week you mentioned an article in Barron's about investing for yield in 2019. And one of the recommendations stuck out to me, Reeves Utility Income, UTG,
yeah,
it's yielded 6.9%, and I just wanted to get your opinion.
Yeah, they've got a long list. Barron's put out this giant list. It looks like a lot of things I invest in, which is interesting. Sometimes we think they bug our, sometimes I think Barron's bugs our office when it comes to these kind of articles. So I'm a big believer. I loved that article. It showed... It really says, and if you, again, if you're listening to Rick and thinking about what Rick's question is, it is a, he's referring to an article in a recent Barron's that lists out all the big income categories and then gives you examples of areas that they like. So they went to U.S. companies and they have a bunch of ETFs that do that and some individual companies for MLPs, all high yielders, real estate. And then in this case, closed-end funds. Now, so UTG, Rick, is the Reeves Utility Income Fund. If you pull this up on Closed-End Fund Connect, I think this is, illustrates a really important point. So closed-end fund is just a basket of securities. I typically own the bond closed-end funds. This is this happens to be a stock closed-end fund. So it's not a lot different than an ETF, just a basket of, call it, couple dozen, in this case, utility companies, which I like utility companies. I've always liked them. In most market cycles, I like them. So the underlying asset here, Rick, is something that I'm a big believer in because they are 2.5% to 5.5% dividend yielders, right? If you, this particular closed end fund, one of the differences about a closed end fund and an ETF is that it doesn't have to be this way, but in this case, this closed-end fund uses leverage. So it takes a type of company that's paying 3.5% on average. It levers it up, in this case, about 20-25%. So you're able to get more yield out of it, and then it's distributing out something like 6.5%, which sounds great. It doesn't mean the utility companies are paying 6.5%. It means the closed-end fund manager decided, hey, let's pay out 6.5%. Again, utilities have a good year. They're levered up a little bit. That all works out really well. Two things that happen, though, in these closed-end funds, and this is the kind of this is the red flag on this particular one, is that you've got to look at the if you go to Closed-End Fund Connect, it shows the net asset value. So what are all the stocks worth in that basket? And then it has another line or chart that shows what the price of the closed-end fund is. You want that price of the closed-end fund to be at or well below what the stocks are worth, or the NAV. And typically, closed-end funds trade that way. Particularly this one, you'll see this thing trade at 5, 6, 8% discounts to the what the stocks are really worth. Today, it's only trading at a 1.5% discount. So even though I like utilities, this fund, in my opinion, is really overpaying for them. You want to wait till this thing is at a 5, 6, 8% discount. A safer bet and something that I own is just XLU, which are utilities in a basket that don't use leverage. That's something that I own. So, more Money Matters right here. News 95.5 at AM 750 WSB. Well, good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here. Wes Moss in the studio here. Welcome to WSB Radio and Money Matters. Here with Ryan Ely every Sunday morning to take your calls and questions and understand what's happening in the world to your investments and the market and what it's doing to your 401k and your 403b and your TSP plan. Or if you have a 457. We're just trying to climb out of what is a bear market for stocks that started in the fall, September 20th, really, to be exact. We hit down 20% the day before Christmas, Christmas Eve day. It was only a half day, cascading. And then we've kind of recovered since then a significant amount, about 10.5% from the very bottom. But was that or is that the bottom, or is it just a fake out? Today, we're going through the history of how these bear markets work so that we can give you a guide to understand what the markets typically do. What does the damage afterwards look like a month out, 2 months out, 5 months out, 10 months out? We mentioned earlier. So today so that is the history of bear markets. I think it's really important to understand the environment that we're probably in over the next year or so. It helps maybe make you a more patient investor, knowing what to expect, at least to some extent, basing markets on history. And they don't ever go back to the exact pattern that we've seen over since 1903, where we pulled all this research from. But very often, there are tremendous similarities. And market patterns rhyme with history, though they don't follow them exactly. The history is very much our guide when it comes to understanding how to be a better investor, knowing what to expect. Also, dividend income in 2019. We had a call just before the break asking about one of the closed-end funds in an article that Barron's published recently, different ways to generate more income in 2019. The reason that's a wonderful list of ideas that show you how do you get, and here's some context. The two-year treasury bond today pays about 2.6, fluctuating between 2.6 and 2.7%. So it's not enough. It's not nothing, but it's not a tremendous amount of income you get sitting in a 10-year bond. What makes that even a little more difficult is 1- and 2-year treasuries yield almost the same amount and they're only a 1 and 2 year bond that you have to buy to do that. On the other side of the income barbell, if you will, you have closed-end funds that are paying 6.5%, 7%, MLPs that are paying 7%, 8%. Relative to a U.S. stock market, which is the S&P 500 as a group, remember, that's 500 big companies in the S&P 500. Some of them pay zero in dividends. Some of them pay significant dividends. As a group, it pays about 1.9%. So if you are an income investor, you want your securities to be paying more than that. You want 3, 3.25, 3.5, 4% from the stock side of the equation. And you want that from companies with really solid balance sheets and foundations. And those companies are getting overlooked. That in the 10 o'clock hour, some of those companies, where they're trading, what those dividend yields are, we're going to talk about that in the 10 o'clock hour. First, I want to finish this bear market history and get through understanding where you can expect markets to go if they do, in fact, rhyme with what they do typically when we hit bear markets in long-term bulls like we're in. We're in a long-term, good market long-term. We think we're still staying out of recession this year at least. We haven't been in recession for now, call it almost a decade, and it's time to understand what this year looks like. We'll also answer the phone. So phone lines are now back open. The number here in the studio, 404-872-0750. Ryan Ely is here. He'll take your call. No matter how many you throw at him, he'll get the phone, answer some of your questions. If you'd like to talk to me, that's the best part of Money Matters, is when we answer questions on the air. And we love to do that. So if you have a pension question or investment question, hey, I'm thinking about buying this, or I own this, and I'm not sure if I should keep owning this, we'll give you our objective advice and maybe something else to think about that you haven't already thought about. And that goes for investments that you hold or thinking about, do I keep holding it? Should I buy this instead? Whether it's mutual funds or annuities or ETFs or individual companies. And then planning, hey, I've got this lump sum offer from my company in 2019, and they're saying I can they'll pay me 3 or 6 months if I leave now and I get a big chunk of money. I only need to work another year or two anyway. Maybe it's time to do it. How do you do that math? I'll give you some of the most important things to think about if you're making one of those kind of early retirement decisions. On the other side of the coin, maybe you just have a question about, hey, I'm getting started and I've got just a little bit amount of money. I have to roll it over or do something with it, sitting in cash doing nothing. What do I do? Well, we'll give you some avenues to explore here. So give us a call here in the studio on this absolutely dreary Sunday morning. I mean, it's cold, it's damp, you're inside or just hanging out listening to Money Matters. Give us a ring here in the studio. Phone lines are open. The number 404-872-0750. Again, 404-872-0750 or outside of Georgia, 1-800-WSB-TALK. That's 1-800-WSB-TALK. Good morning. Peak to trough, we just said before the break, on average, it takes 9 months for markets to, on average, to really put in a bottom. And that is, again, for, and by the way, the average decline in these cyclical short-term bear markets or in good market trends like we're in over longer-term strong trends, we call them secular bulls. Markets, when they drop, and this is data going all the way back to 1903, on average, these bear markets are 21.8%. Call it 21, 22%. We got there, almost. We were down 20% on Christmas Eve, by Christmas Eve. We almost hit that exact level that is typical for these bear markets. Now, when you're in a secular bear or a long-term bear, these pullbacks are worse. We just don't think we're in one of those cycles. If we happen to be in a longer-term bear market, those average declines are 30 over 30%, and it takes 15 months to hit bottom, and it takes 4.5 years to get back to peak. We don't think we're in one of those environments. Again, we think we're in a long-term bull, and this is a cyclical or short-term pullback. Now, how long does it take to get from trough back to peak? So let's presume that we put in the bottom. On average, remember, it takes 9 months from top to bottom. Remember, we're only about month 4 in this correction so far. once you bottom historically, it then takes a little less than a year to get back to even. It takes 11 months. The number is 11 months on average to get back to the old peak on average. So the whole cycle on average takes some time, about 20 months, call it about a little over a year and a half. So if we're using history as a guide, the bottom should be around the late spring, call it May, before we are in a sustainable then rally path where the market's put in a solid bottom. Just remember, this is a healing process. When markets kind of hit a brick wall or hit a huge speed bump and the car flies up in the air and the coffee mugs hit the windshield, it takes some time to gather itself. It takes some time to heal. And it's not during that healing process that takes some time. It's not uncommon to get a 10%, 15% rally, which is right where we are right now. We're at a 10.5% rally so far. So then maybe then typically, or can what very often happens, then you kind of roll back over and you test those lows. History is, of course, history. History is great, but it is in the past. And we never know when markets really, we don't know the day the market bottoms, even when it does. So until we're able to look back in the rear of your mirror and say, of course, hey, that was the market bottom. On March 16th, let's say, 2009, if you pull up a chart, even though we're in a, even though the market had rallied, we know now the low was March 9th. That was the bottom of the Great Recession and the great stock market sell-off. Even though now we know that the bottom was March 9th, a week later, if you go to March 16th, so about a week after the bottom, the market had rallied a lot like it just has. It was up 11%. Even though we are a week into what would then become a massive multi-year rally, you couldn't definitively say, oh, last week, March 9th, that was the bottom. Sure, we know now, but we didn't know on March 10th, even though markets had just started to take off, we didn't know that March 9th, the day before, was the bottom. Now, here's another thing that's interesting about what happened this past, really the past week or so, or a little more than that, trading days, last 10 days, let's say, since we bottomed in Christmas. What we do know about markets and when they change sentiment, there's a massive shift over the last 10 days in buying and selling activity. So we look at something called the advanced decline line. Ryan in there is just getting excited when we're talking advanced decline. That if you think, what's the advanced decline line? What's exactly what it's exactly what it sounds like. It basically compares the number of stocks that closed higher against the number of stocks that closed lower than the previous day's closing prices. So advanced decline day. So measure of this over a 10-day period on the climactic selling day of Christmas Day 2018 was minus 2,440. So the advanced decline line, 10-day advanced decline, was negative 2,440. That was the worst advanced decline sell-off that we'd seen since 2011. But over the next 10 days, which really brings us to trading days, which brings us to about last week, the advanced decline line rocketed to a positive 1,938. That's a 4,003, almost a 4,400-point swing. What's interesting about that is that's one of the largest and most severe shifts, and in this case, to the positive, that we've seen in 30 years. And similar to a reading back in December of 2008, which was very close to the bottom of 2009. So that is an interesting. So I'm not calling the all clear signal yet on this market, and it's important to remember that putting in a trough or a bottom usually takes 9 months, not four. We were only 4 months in. But a shift like we've just seen over the past few weeks certainly shows signs of strength in sentiment. Again, good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. That's the period of time. So think 9 months to hit bottom, 11 months to get back to where we were. So the whole cycle is a 20-month or so, year and a half, a little more than a year and a half. Bottom line here, despite all this market action, and again, a big part of that is we've seen a shift into some of the biggest swing areas that can go really bad or could get a lot better that we wrote about in the 2019 outlook. The two swing areas for this year are China, relationship with China and trade, tariffs, and the Fed. And in just in a very short period of time, both of those items, both of those very significant overhangs of the market have lightened up. The Fed has blatantly come out almost with cheerleaders and said, hey, every Fed governor's come out, including Powell, and said, hey, no, just we're not getting crazy here with rates. We're going slow. We're going to go at very measured pace. We're looking at the data. We don't want to choke off this economy. They've said it over and over and over again since mid-December when everyone thought they're ready to raise rates into oblivion. That's not happening. That's good news. Market likes it. We've also seen positive talks with China. They're not throwing things at each other all week. They're actually talking. Maybe they're getting some progress on a trade deal. Market has loved both of those areas. Another reason why we've seen this shift or swing to a positive sentiment. So bottom line here, Mark, despite all this action signaling a shift from sentiment from negative back to positive, history tells us that bottoming, it's a process in this, even in these mild bear markets, and if you look at history to guide this bottoming process, still has a little way to go, a little longer to go. The better news is that markets are sniffing a calmer, more patient Fed and a calm in the U.S.-China storm, at least for now. More Money Matters, your calls straight ahead, 404-872, the number here in the studio, 404-872-0750. More Money Matters straight ahead. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here. WSB Radio. Headed into the 10 o'clock hour. Remember, we're talking about dividend income and companies that are getting underappreciated, even though they have really strong balance sheets. At least when I say underappreciated, I'm just saying that we look at if people pay up or not. You look at really the true price tag of a company is not the stock price, whether it's trading at $52 or $1,052. That's not the price tag I'm talking about. Isn't that stock high? I'll hear that. Isn't that stock high? It's trading at $700. No. The actual price of the shares, that's not what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter at all. A $6 stock. Isn't that stock cheap relative to the stock that's $600? Nope. Doesn't matter at all what the price is. What matters is what you're paying for those shares relative to the earnings. It's a little more complicated than just what the price is on the screen. It's price divided by the earnings or the future earnings over the next year, the forward earnings. Right now, if you look at the general market, think about in as an aggregate, if this whole market was a team of horses pulling a plow forward into the world, that it would be putting out the horsepower of about $170 worth of earnings. $170. The earlier estimates that have come down were $180. So in aggregate, the whole 500 the S&P 500 as a group, they're putting out $170 for 2019 in earnings, or $170 in horsepower. That's what makes markets either expensive or cheap. It's the earnings, right? That's the denominator. It's not what the headline price is. So when I'm saying that a company is being underappreciated, I'm saying that it's trading at let's take the market as the baseline. So that's a 2360, let's say, for the S&P 500. Let me click on this and make sure I get these numbers right. For as of the S&P 500 as of today, or let's call it as of this week, is trading at about 2,600. This is the S&P 500. Obviously, I'm talking about the Dow. Expected to earn about $168 in aggregate. You do that math, and you're trading at about 15 and a half times earnings. The price is about 15 and a half times earnings. So if a company is trading at 13 times earnings, that's technically trading below the general market. Now, it gets more complicated than that because you want to look at that company relative to its peers in its sector. But let's just start out and say, when I say underappreciated, what I'm saying is that investors are not paying up, or they're not paying a higher multiple for that company. If the market in general is trading at 15.5 and a company's trading at 12 times, it's basically on sale or cheaper. If it's trading at 25 times earnings and the market's at 15, then it's people are paying up, up, up. They're paying higher prices, if you will, for that company. So that's the context we'll talk about in the 10 o'clock hour for companies that have almost no debt. We call it zero net debt, or we call it just companies that are able to pay the bills. I like that. More Money Matters in the 10 o'clock hour straight ahead.
It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss, certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters here in the 10 o'clock hour. Wes Moss here with Ryan Ealy, and we are taking you through the first hour of the show. We took you through the history of bear markets. We know that it takes a full 9 months, usually on average, to trough out, bottom out. Then it takes about 11 months to get back to where we were, called a 20-month cycle. Okay, next. If we called it anything, I'd call it an information overload hour that's about to be here on Money Matters as we talk through. We're going to go to the category of income. And within income, we're not going to talk about bonds. We're not going to talk about alternative income investments like MLPs or closed-end funds. We're going to talk about the dividend area, the third stream of the three that arguably is the most steady and powerful. We're talking dividend income, stock dividend income right here. And then we'll go to the phones. And then in the back half of this hour, heading up to 11 o'clock, and this is the article that you'll find in the AJC that we just wrote, entitled "How Rich Are You?" What are the household demographics in the United States when it comes to millionaire households? How many of them are there? What's the percentage? Folks in the 1 to 5 range, the 5 to 25 million range, and the 25 million plus range. Whoa, what are the statistics on that? And where do you stand? What's even middle class? How do you define middle class in America? Anyway, good morning. And then, so once we're done with dividends, we're going to have some time to answer your questions here on the air as the most objective financial show you're going to find in America, hopefully. I that's my opinion. And the number here in the studio, Ryan Ealy, standing by to take your call. So phone lines are open. The number, 404-872-0750. Get ready, get out a pen, ready to write it down. Maybe you wrote down the number from last week and you didn't get to call. We're going to do it today. The number, give us a call here in the studio, 404-872-0750. Again, the number outside of Georgia, 1-800-WSB-TALKS. You're listening in Texas and Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. Hello, good morning. The number, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Yes. Good morning. Yes. We talk about money. We talk about income here all the time. We just had a great call asking about a utility income closed-end fund. Paid 6% a year. Sounds good. Got to be careful on that, but I still like utilities. What about, so of course, the big three, that was a loud computer noise. I don't know where it came from. The big three, of course, are interest from various bonds. Dividends, again, we're going to talk about today, from a tremendous variety of stocks. And then, of course, distributions that come from other areas of the market, publicly traded real estate investment trusts, energy pipeline companies, closed-end funds, great. All lots of places to go. Today, I want to focus on the dividend piece of that equation. Here are five things that I think you get when you focus on that dividend piece of the equation. Here are five things. One, high-quality dividend stocks have a yield or a cash flow or a free cash flow that's nearly double the general market. That's number one. Number two, high-quality dividend stocks have a yield that is about 40% higher than owning 10-year U.S. Treasury bonds. Number three, high-quality dividend stocks offer protection from the mountain of corporate debt that's facing U.S. companies over the next couple of years. Number four, high-quality dividend companies the ones that have very low debt, or in some cases negative net debt, that means that they have more cash on hand than they do debt. They could just pay off all their debt tomorrow if they wanted to, that are not trading at premiums to the rest of the market. That's an interesting group. Back to the 9 o'clock hour, underappreciated. So investors are not paying up for that high quality where maybe they should be. And then on the other side of the equation, low quality companies, so bad balance sheets, low dividends or no dividends, those stocks are not trading at a discount to the rest of the market. And maybe they should be. Maybe they're overappreciated. So essentially what this means is that high quality companies right now are inexpensive relative to the general market. And low quality companies, I think are expensive. And this is just me here. Remember, there are so many ways to invest. And if you're a portfolio manager and you're listening to me and you're a growth oriented manager, you're like, yeah, no, I don't believe in any of that crap you're talking about, Wes. That's not the way we do it. And what we do is just fine. And you're right. It very well could be just as good or better over time. So investing, though, remember, is just a philosophy. It's a philosophical way to approach long-term wealth creation. And there are dozens of core different ways to do it. We just happen to do income here on Money Matters. That's been the theme of this show for over 20 years. And as long as I'm here, that theme will continue to persist. So just remember that as far as a philosophy. I think it really matters as you head into retirement. I think that if there's any time to become an investor or understand income investing, it's when you're about ready to get into retirement, or maybe you're in retirement and you're sick of so much fluctuation and worried about this growth company, that growth company. You just want consistency from equities. You still want to own equities, but I want consistency, and it needs to be significant enough that I notice it and actually pays the bills. The dividend piece of the equation actually pays the bills. There's a lot of power in that. Not just from a financial perspective, but psychologically, it is a very powerful way to be able to invest and train yourself so that you're not freaked out every time we have some sort of government shutdown, partial government shutdown, war with China, Fed says something you don't like, and you get through that with greater ease. Because the one thing we know about dividends, particularly if we choose the companies carefully, is they don't change. Yeah, they can change, of course, and they can get cut. But if you own 100 good dividend companies, 99 of them or 98 of the 100 are going to be the same or higher payouts next year too, and then higher the next year. If we do end up in a credit bubble, which means too many companies have too much debt and they can't pay off the debt or refinance over the next couple of years, and this isn't like an imminent threat today, but over the next couple of years, there's been trillions in corporate debt amassed. And if that isn't, that could create a problem. What kind of stocks are going to make it through a storm like that? Though it's going to be the high-quality, low-debt companies that are able to do that. The ones that I like to own, again, that list of five high-quality, low-debt companies that pay above-market dividends. What is, Wes, the market in general is, and we go back to this kind of what's the baseline? Well, it's the S&P 500. It's 500 biggest companies in America trading at 15 and a half times. So you take the price of the S&P 500, 2,600 about, divided by what we expect it to earn next year, 168, you get 15 and a half times. That's what investors are paying up for S&P 500 earnings. What's the yield? So if you buy the general market, what is your dividend yield from those 500 companies? It's 1.9%. So it's interestingly, it's not nothing. You still get some dividend from the S&P 500. But it's not enough to really move the meter as far as the way I look at this. So I want to own companies that are, call it 40, 50% more than that. In some cases, 100% more than that, right? So if the market yield is, it's under two, but let's call it two, I want to own something that pays four. It's 100% more, right? It's really not 2%, but 4%. Here's how you would screen. How do you select those companies? If you were to have a big colander or strainer, and you threw 1,000 companies into the strainer, after 10 minutes of straining, what is left in a really, really difficult or stringent is the word, screen. If you're screening out companies that are only a certain way and that high quality, those high quality metrics I just mentioned earlier, when you're left with a handful, call it a dozen or so companies, what are you screening out? Well, you start with your universe. And in this case, I start with the S&P 500 universe and then screen out anybody that's not at least $5 billion and above in size, right? Then number two, you screen, here's the five-step screening process in general. Then you screen for only companies with reasonable forward multiples. So you look at, you cut out any companies that have 22, 25, 30, people are overpaying for those companies. You screen them out because they're, quote, expensive. Then you screen, now step three, you screen out all the companies that aren't growing their dividend at least 4% a year. You want there to be an actual ratcheting up of what they're paying out at least 4% a year. So if you're not doing that, screen them out. Then number four, you look at a particular free cash flow level. So that is one of the number one sign, is a company really making money or not. So free cash flow level, and then that level also screen to relative to that company's debt levels. So how much cash at the end of the day that they have relative to what their bond, their debt payments are. And then further, step five is you further screen for several different metrics that take into account earnings relative to debt. What am I earning in general relative to how do I service my debt? You end up with companies that are, now this is how I do it. Again, this is just philosophically how I do it. This doesn't necessarily mean the way you need to do it. I find that basket or what's left in that colander, those are attractively priced companies that have growing dividends. To me, that's the kind of company I want to own in a downturn. And I want to own it even more so when we go through a market upswing. I want to own it in both environments. Now, here is an example of what that looks like from what are some of the metrics here? I'm going to give three companies as a basket, that just as an example, and talk about what they yield. So what are these companies paying out as a group in dividend yield? And then what are people paying for it? What's the forward PE for this? Well, it's a radio, so we're going to leave you hanging. So you've got to wait till after the break. It is radio. So good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. We're going to talk about those three companies when Money Matters returns. Stay tuned. More Money Matters. Straight ahead, News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. And we are back. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Wes Moss here, your host. Ryan Ely, of course. And talking about finding companies that pay more, a lot more than the general market and a lot more than government bonds. The topic, of course, here, finding and screening down in your colander bowl in the sink, you're shaking 500 and now you come out with 12. Boom. Here's what they do. Here are three examples of a few that have, again, we're looking for high quality dividend companies that have yield or good cash flow. You want them to have you want to be paying at or below what the general market is paying up for companies. You want their dividends to be also growing. Then you want free cash flow to be healthy relative to their debt levels. And that's so effectively you want companies in the next down cycle that can weather a really tough storm. And I picked a little basket here of companies that have virtually no debt, or virtually it's not that they don't have debt. They have almost negative net debt. In a couple of cases here, they have negative net debt, means they could pay off, they could have enough cash to just pay off all their debt. And in one case, there's a tiny bit from a percentage standpoint in debt. Here's this little basket. I want to, again, we talked about how the S&P 500 yields as a dividend yield 1.9%. Here are three companies. Think about these as a basket: Cisco, BlackRock, and Cummins. Cisco, BlackRock, and Cummins. So think BlackRock's this massive financial services firm. Cisco, massive tech firm, dominant in networking, hardware, telecom equipment, and Internet of Things, which is, again, part of the future. And then Cummins, it's one of the biggest engine and power system manufacturing companies on the planet. The basket of companies, they have virtually zero net debt. You look at, if you look at BlackRock, they have negative net debt. If you look at Cisco, they have way more cash than they do debt. And then Cummins only has 1.7% in net debt. Some companies have 40, 50, 60% in debt. So the if you look at what does that basket of companies pay as a dividend yield? Well, the dividend yield on those three is 42% higher than just the general market. As a group, it trades at a slightly lower forward PE than the rest of the market. It means it's the market underappreciates it relative to the S&P 500. So right now, I think this, and again, I think it'll change, the market's not giving much credence to these ultra-high-quality companies, these ultra-high-quality balance sheet companies, at least. Doesn't mean they have the best growth rates in town, but they have kind of the hardiest foundation, if you will. On top of that, many of these companies pay significantly more income than the rest of the market. Some of my dividend list is in the 4 and 5% range or dividend yield that I own, which of course is more than 100% higher or double the general market. But as a group, you're getting here a yield of over three and a quarter. Cisco's over three, almost 3.1. BlackRock's 3.25. Cummins is 3.44. So as a group, they yield about 3.25 just in dividends. So if the prices stayed flat for the year, you'd at least get 3.25%. Now, again, that's not making you rich, but most families, when they're doing their planning, are trying to stay in the 3.5 to 5.5% range as far as what are you pulling out from your investments. Remember the 4% rule? That's kind of the that's kind of the middle of the road distribution or withdrawal rate. You want to try to target 4% plus inflation. This gets you most of the way there just in the dividend. Big reason why we like it. At least that's how I do it. I'm not saying go out, run out and buy these companies. I'm saying these are things that I do and I think that makes sense. Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. When Money Matters returns, we're taking your phone calls. We're talking about statistics of millionaires in America. When Money Matters returns. Good morning. Welcome back. So Money Matters here, WSB Radio. Wes Moss here for Money Matters. A lot today on the show. We've covered the history of bear markets, how long these things typically take until they crater out, and then how long it takes to get back to where we were. So peak to trough, then trough to peak. That cycle, where are we in this cycle? Well, we could be coming out of it. We've had some really strong market activity over the last 10 trading days, last couple weeks. But we're only about 4 months into the bear, and typically it takes longer than that. So that's why it wouldn't surprise me if it takes till this spring before we truly bottom out and then truly head higher. Again, the macro issues are a big part of that. Obviously, you still got to get a deal done with China. By the way, you got to get the government reopened at some point. That is a big deal. That's got to happen. Obviously, the market hasn't cared about the government shutdown or the partial shutdown. At some point, it will start to care. You've got to get a deal with China, and the Fed is already kind of checked the box and calmed down. Of course, there'll be some other things that happen this year, and they'll get hit with things out of the blue that weren't on the radar. But the big picture of this is that later in the year is when markets historically will turn to kind of get out of their bear funk and can move higher. The next piece of what we talked about today has to do with how do you screen for companies that have really strong balance sheets. They're not the fastest growing companies, but they are companies that make a lot of money and they don't have a lot of debt. In some cases, they have negative net debt, meaning they can pay it off tomorrow. Those are companies that can really weather a storm. And if they pay twice the amount or 50% more than the general stock market dividend, then that's attractive to me. That's how I like to invest. And I give you some examples of companies that are doing that right now that I like or I own personally. Again, not saying rush out, and buy everything that I talk about here, but these are real life examples of things that I tend to like as an investor. But everyone's different, and I've always got to acknowledge that here on Money Matters, and you know that as you listen. You know that we're all different, our risk tolerances are different, our time horizons are different, our goals are different, and so forth. What we're going to get to, kind of how rich are you, I want to go through statistics about levels of wealth in America. It kind of gives us a gauge of what everybody else is doing. Kind of, where do you stand? If you have this amount of money, where do you stand relative to the rest of the world? I get that question actually a lot. Hey, how am I doing? Which really is a question of how am I doing relative to everybody else? No, nobody ever says relative to everybody else, but that's kind of what you're asking. When you're thinking, how am I doing in America? Well, you're really saying, how am I doing relative to what most people are doing? We're going to get to some of those statistics. I do want to go to the phones here, and we've got time for at least one call, maybe a couple more. So if you have a financial question, maybe it's just a Roth IRA question, or maybe it's a regular IRA or 401k or a TSP or a 403b question. Hey, what am I doing inside this TSP or my 401k? We'll give you objective advice here on Money Matters. It's what we love to do. I think it's the greatest part of the show. If you're thinking about something or just kind of been on your mind or weighing on you financially, maybe it's a pension versus lump sum decision you've got to make, or a 401k allocation decision. So many other people are worried about the same thing. So many other folks out there have these same questions because, you know, I do this every single day, all week, all year. And it's amazing at the amount of things that I constantly need help on and refreshers on. And I've got an entire over a dozen people on our investment committee that we meet constantly, and we're constantly asking these questions or say, "Hey, what was that again? What is the history here?" So, and I do this every day. So I can only imagine if you're not full time in investments, how opaque it must be, or how difficult it must seem, or confusing, or complex. And we really do truly want to help folks through that. And so that's what we do here on the show. So if you have questions, we love to answer them here on the air. You don't have to use your name. You can just say, you know, you're Joe from Stockbridge. I don't know. Nobody knows who's calling. So give us a call. The number in the studio, 404-872-0750. Again, 404-872-0750. Or if you're outside of Georgia, the number 1-800-WSB-TALK. That's 1-800-972-8255. So we'll start here with Josh incoming. Josh, what's your question? How can I help?
Hello. I'm wondering how long of a way from retirement do you have to be to not have bonds? If you're over 25 years away from retirement, should you ever have bonds?
That's a kind of an important thought, is that we talk all about stocks and we talk about all these different categories, but it really comes down to what Josh is asking. If you've got 25 full years and you don't need to touch your investment money, it's just you sock it away, it's invested. Do you even need to mess with the safety and stability of bonds? Right now they're paying, call it 2.5% to 4.5%, right? So if you're a stock investor, you say, big whoop, who cares? I can own stocks that are doing the same thing and they have upside potential. Why would I ever own bonds that are only paying me 3 or 3.5% and I have almost no upside potential beyond that? The answer is if you have zero care about fluctuation and you can take the full brunt of stocks going up and down and up and down, and then over time, you're probably better off in all stocks, and you may not need any bonds. But even for aggressive investors, there's something called the efficient frontier in investing that shows how you can maximize your return with the least amount of volatility. So if you look at what an efficient frontier curve, it shows that you can still get most of the upside of all stocks with a fair amount less fluctuation if you just add a little bit into the bond category. So the answer here is that you can get most of the return if you just add a little bit or inject a little bit of safety and stability into your portfolio. So I think if for more aggressive investors, the 80% stock, 20% bond mix is still, I think it still makes a lot of sense because it does buffer you in certain situations. It does spread out the different kind of asset classes you have. And I think that's really important as an investor. If you don't care at all about fluctuation up and down, you have no worries when your stocks are down 40%, then you don't necessarily need to do that. But for most folks, injecting a little bit of safety and stability into an otherwise to an otherwise relatively volatile asset, which are, of course, stocks, the combination of that, even a little bit of safety, I think goes a little bit of safety or stability goes a very long way over time, proven out by the efficient frontier philosophy that we just talked about. So again, yes, over 25 years, do you still need bonds? I think for most investors, the answer is yes. Ryan Ely, where do we go next? 404-872-0750, going to John in Cleveland, Georgia. John, what's going on? How can we help?
Hey, I went to my banker the other day to try to buy some CDs, and he talked me into buying a short-term mutual fund, and it just hasn't yielded a lot in the last 6 months. He said there's a $1,000 penalty if I try to get out of the short-term before the 1 year mark is over.
$1,000 so $1,000 less in interest, or $1,000 on the entire thing?
On the entire thing.
How much did you?
That's 1%.
$1,000.
I think it was a 1% penalty.
So did you put $100,000 in?
Yeah.
Interesting. So it is a mutual fund that means that he got paid 1%, John. So it's a 1% product that they sold you. And what's the yield? How much is the yield?
Not a whole lot. It is very, very low. And I tried to talk to him about that, but he just said it is on the up and up, and he showed me some very convincing graphs.
Yeah. Here's my thought. If you're putting money into a bank that is really just meant to be there in a year because you're going to use it for something like building a house or paying for education, and it's money that's relatively has a use in the short term, I think that investing in some of those slightly higher yielding products is fine. I think that's fine. But you've got to remember, you don't need to do that because you can just buy a treasury bond today for 2.5% and sell it in a year and there's no penalty. And you'll get almost zero movement in that, meaning from a price perspective. It's not a product that somebody is selling you that you have to pay money to. And you can get your net yield of, call it, 2.5% and not have to mess with a product that locks you in. So, yeah, he probably put you in a short-term bond fund that yields 2.5% or 2.75%. It could go up by another 0.5%. So you could get 3% out of this thing. That's great. But I just don't – so it's probably fine as long as you do hold it the entire year. My message to you and other folks listening – when you're in that situation, you have some shorter term money that you just want to keep safe. You don't want to buy any sort of product with it that has any sort of contingency or contingent sales charge. Hey, if you get out of this, it's going to charge you 1%. It's a grand. A, you didn't make any money. B, you lost $1,000 when you were supposed to be putting money into something just safe. So I think of really short term bonds, 1 year, 2 year treasuries, you get 2.5 and you don't have to worry about your liquidity. You can sell these things at any minute of any time during the day. So probably it's an okay, your probably end result will still be okay. I just don't like to get locked up into a product when you don't have to. There's so many other options that'll probably do just as well or better, and the money's yours to get to at any point. Okay, where are we headed next, Ryan? We're headed to Tony in Gainesville. Tony in Gainesville, welcome to Money Matters, my friend. How can we help?
Hey, man, good morning. Hey, I was wanting to know if there's a way to do a proper analysis between putting money a vehicle tax-free over a working career, like mutual funds, like a TSP account, versus a Roth IRA. It seems like you get the benefit of reduce taxable income by dumping as much as you can into a pre-tax mutual fund and earning the return over a 30-year working career versus maybe putting it into a Roth.
Well,
and going that route. So I didn't know if there's a way to properly compare those two to see which one might be better.
Tony, you're right. It is a little bit. Wait a minute. This one has an advantage up front. So a 401k or 403b, or you put money in, it's pre-tax. You get a break there, but then you got to pay tax in the future. A Roth, you pay taxes, put it in, then no tax in the future. So it's really a taxes today versus taxes in the future equation. The reality here, what I see in the real world, is that most folks get into a pretty high bracket while you're working. So you're 25 to 30% or more while you're working. And then you get a retirement and it drops all the way down to 15. So it makes it so yes, the tax-free one works in the future, and I love the tax-free nature, but you got to pay a lot of money to get into the tax-free one. So they to some extent, they both have their advantages, and they both have a little bit of a disadvantage. So the answer is you really want to do both, because the Roth doesn't let you put that much in anyway. So you put you call it $6,000 into a Roth a year. You can put almost $20,000 into 401k. The answer is you want to be able to do both of those. They both have over, if you weigh all options on disadvantage and advantage on both of those, they're both really good vehicles for the long run. And how do you compare it? There's tools online to be able to compare the two. Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. When Money Matters gets back, we've got maybe time for one more call. We're going to talk about millionaire statistics. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Ryan, are we ready for a prize pack? I don't know if we fixed the microphone in there, did we?
I think we fixed the microphone.
Oh, sounds so good. You sound like
so much.
You sound like George
week.
Strait.
The weekend prize pack is a pair of tickets to see the Beach Boys, led by Mike Love and Bruce Johnston, live in concert Sunday, January 20th at Cobb Energy Performing Arts Center. Tickets are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com.
I like it. All right, so we need to do, we promised we'd do millionaire statistics. And this is going to run in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in the business section soon. If it's not today, it'll be next Sunday. I don't even know, but it's already written. And here are the highlights of that. And we're thinking about, you know, where do you stand? Where do you stand relative to the rest of the world? Well, because we tend to think that everyone around us, oh, everybody's just like me. I've got some money, but everybody around me has money. Here are the statistics. There were 10.8 million American households that were identified as millionaires in a recent study, in a 2017 study by the Spectrum Group. And it actually, if you dig into that, it's really the value of everything you own except primary residence. So if you got a private residence paid for, it's $500,000, $500,000 house. That doesn't count towards the millionaire study that was done here. Everything else does. So the value of a business, your of course, retirement accounts, investment accounts, rental property that you own that has positive equity, of course, that's in the net worth. So here's the data. It says household data. And by the way, there's 325 million people in the United States. There's 126 million households. There are, so the millionaire category from 1 to 5 million, total net worth, over $1 million, 9.4 million households. That's 7.4% of the population. So it's less than 1 in 10. There's 100 people in a room in America, 7 of them have a net worth of $1 million. That's the statistics. 93 of them do not. 5 million to 25 million, so 5 million or more, about 1.3 million households. That's 1%. That's 1% of the population. And then 25 million plus more, 156,000 of those folks are 0.12. So 0.1% of the population in that $25 million category more. I know there's a lot more to talk about on this, but we're running out of time. So good. Thanks for tuning in with us. We so appreciate it for your calls, questions. Sorry we didn't get to all the phones. All of our calls came in the last half hour. We had like 50 of them. So we got to the ones we could get to find me and our team throughout the week. We are right here in Atlanta, actually in Sandy Springs. You can just find me on our website, wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. There's a contact button in the upper right-hand corner. Those emails come straight to me. They come straight to me and our team. Again, that's at wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. Have a wonderful, profitable rest of the day.